you really know me and you know that problems and questions and puzzles are the things that drive me, then you'll understand very easily why I would want to read business books. Because well-written business books, and believe me, there are a lot of not well-written business books, but the really good ones are about solving problems and about thinking and how to approach problems and how to think about complexities. That's why I picked up this book. The book that I'm talking about today, in case you didn't read the title, is The Hard Thing About Hard Things, Building a Business When There Are No Easy Answers by Ben Horowitz. You may never have heard of Ben Horowitz. Ben Horowitz is part of probably one of the biggest, or at least most successful, venture capital firms in the world. It's called Andreessen Horowitz, or A16Z. I might just know who they are because I'm from Silicon Valley. But there's something else to Ben from before. Actually, this book, the bulk of this book, happens before Andreessen Horowitz. It takes place in what I like to call the fertile period of the internet, the time when Silicon Valley was just exploding. So you had this late 70s and you had the 80s where things were burgeoning and things were being created. The Apple computer was just coming out of a garage. You know, that's the whole mythology there. But then when you get to the 90s, the late 80s, the 90s, the early 2000s, that period, that's when people actually start to use the internet. You know, the internet existed technically. I guess it wasn't really the internet, but being able to communicate computer to computer, that existed for a while. Most people didn't do it. When I was, I think, 17 years old, I'm 43 now, just to clarify. When I was 17, I had never owned a computer. Some of you, if you're younger than me, may find that shocking that people grew up without computers. They were expensive. I grew up with a single mother. We didn't have it. We didn't have the money, for one. I did my homework when I could. You were still able to handwrite homework. But when you had to turn in a paper, I had to bust out the typewriter. I had to type up my homework. And then when I was 17, my best friend's parents, his dad was very much into computers. And so were he and his older brother. And they were a computer household. And they had households. They had computers. They knew how to build computers. So they gave me one. They had one already built and they gave me one. And that was the first computer I ever owned. And I didn't think I'd be telling this story, but it was still early enough that I was typing into DOS. There was no Windows. You had to type in, you know, CD / and DIR and all of these commands, which for some odd reason I still remember. And then within a few years, we entered this period of the internet that I'm talking about here in relation to Ben Horowitz, where computers were, you could get games on floppy disks from your friends up until that point, and you could get a program, maybe, but the programs had to fit on a disk. You know, you couldn't install it onto the computer. And you could go, quote unquote, I'm using air quotes here, online, but there were these things called bulletin boards and you had to dial in with the computer. It's been so long, I don't even remember what we did on those bulletin boards. But then I went off to college in 96, 97, and they had this crazy thing. They gave us all email addresses. And you could go, I had the computer in my room, but you could go to the library and use the computers in the library, which I would go do because the computer I had in my room was still that other computer with DOS. But the one in the library had Windows. And you could surf the internet. What's that mean? That's the time that Ben Horowitz really, I think, you would say he earned his name. He worked for some pretty famous companies at that time. Now, most people don't remember these companies because that's how technology goes, especially internet and technology. Computer technology, they just go so fast that like so many people don't even remember what Yahoo is. And this stuff is from before Yahoo. But he worked for Netscape and Silicon Valley Graphics. Those were two huge, huge companies. And then he was CEO of LoudCloud and Opsware. And LoudCloud and Opsware, his time as CEO is kind of pretty much the bulk of this book. So that's just all background, not only on me, time period of computers, I guess, given history lessons, I guess, and a little bit about who Ben Horowitz is. But what I really enjoyed about this book is he approaches the problems of being a CEO from the perspective of problems. He could very easily just go in and write a book that's all stories. And there are stories in here. But for the most part, the stories relate to problems and to solving problems and to facing difficulty. And I think it gives it a nice grounding. Because as much as, you know, biography, memoir, stories, or whatever are interesting, if I'm picking up a business book, like I said earlier, I'm picking it up because I want to hear the problems and how you face them. And not just in the story. I want to hear you tell the story, but then I want to hear the abstraction of it too. Give me the theory, give me the philosophy. Because that's where it really becomes applicable to me. I'm not a CEO. I don't have aspirations of being a CEO. So if I just take the stories, they're not as meaningful to me because they're not going to be applicable. Sorry. Apparently I'm losing control of my tongue. Applicable to my own life. Now I'm nervous about saying that word. Am I saying it weird now? But when you give me the abstractions, you give me the philosophy behind what you're doing, then I can see how that fits in other situations. One of the most interesting things about that in this book is what I call unseen repercussions. He talks about how there are these decisions that you have to make, and they seem very simple, but there's a complexity and a long tail to them that it isn't a decision that's just contained in that moment. That they are these things that if you don't know this, that you could create something that just, you can create monsters. So what I'm going to share with you is really just in this, I'm not a book review in the sense that, you know, this isn't a book report for a teacher where I tell you everything in the book. I'm just going to tell you some of the parts that I found interesting. And even the parts that I'm going to tell you are just part of what I found was interesting. This is just the stuff that I think would be cool to talk about and somebody would want to listen to. There are other notes that I took that maybe only mean something to me or value to me. So let's go through a couple of these unseen repercussions so you can kind of understand what I mean. And maybe you'll think they're as cool as I do. Not because they're problems, but just because like I love seeing clarity of thought. Like, whoa. I would not have realized that those things would happen from that action. So then it makes me think about other places in my life, like where there are unseen repercussions in my life. in my projects, in things that I'm doing. So one of the smaller points, and I say smaller point in the sense that there's not a lot of coverage of this. It's a brief passing point, I guess, but I broke it out a little bit more. He talks about the idea of when you are a big company, sorry, when you're a small company, the tendency for some people or the desire for some people is to hire executives from big companies. Because you can kind of understand like the thought process behind that. We're small, they're big. You know, they got to the big show. They know how to do that stuff. So we can bring them here and they'll make our small company big. But Horowitz actually says that's a bad idea. He says what you should actually do is hire small company executives to work in small companies. And then as the company grows, you're going to cycle through people. Those people are going to no longer, you know, they'll reach a certain point where they can't deal with what's in front of them. And then that's when you look for an executive from a company that has those problems. You know, whether it's you're going from small to medium to large, you're going to slowly upsize your executives as you upsize your company. And the reason for that is, at least in dealing with the difference between big and small company executives, is that big company executives, they're essentially they're defense driven. Because they work in a big company, most of their job is interruption and reaction based. What I mean by that is, what he means by that is that they can sit in their office and they're going to get a ton of calls. The calls are just going to come into them. They're going to get a ton of emails, and the emails are just going to be coming to them. And the deals are just going to be coming in. Everything's going to be coming at them. They're going to be, all of this stuff's going to be thrown at them. So the big company execs are good at dealing with this influx, this chaos that's coming at them and reacting to it. They're defensive. They're goalies. Whereas small company executives, they need to go out and get things. They can't sit in their office and wait because those emails and those calls and those deals are not coming in because it's a small company. They have to go out and make shit happen. Sitting and waiting for a small company executive is death, not just of the executive, but death of the company. So if you bring in someone who is defensive driven, like a big company executive into a company that needs offense, you've got the wrong lineup, to go with the sports metaphor. You got the wrong players. When you need a quarterback, you don't send in your linebacker. So I thought that was an interesting twist right there. You know, like I wouldn't think about that. I would think exactly that mindset of, yeah, bring in the best of the best. That's the way we think of it. But when you bring in the best of the best, you have to bring in the best for the situation that you're in. Which means the best of the best for a small company is the best of the best of small company executives. Not the big guys. He also talks about this, something that comes up, and I'm sure it comes up in the Silicon Valley a lot, is hiring employees from a friend's company. So CEOs, they become friends, right? You know, they go to the same meetings and probably the same bars, and they're around each other and they become buddies because they're kind of in a similar position. You know, similar to like in the military, you know, officers become friends with officers because there's this separation between the upper and the lower, and sometimes that's necessary. So when you have a friend that's a CEO of another company, sometimes a situation comes up where through no action of your own, you find out that someone from your friend's company, she has an employee that is applying for a job. at your company. Like, she's about to lose an employee, but an employee is going to bail, and they want to bail to your company. And because you're the CEO, of course, you don't know that this person's already been through, you know, like 3 or 4 interviews in the hiring process. You know, you're not on the ground level. You're just finding out about this. So you have this conundrum, right? Do I hire this person that's going to leave my friend's company? What do I do here? Now, obviously, it's not a binary situation where you do one or the other. Most people, I think, if I was put in this situation, I would be what I'm clarifying as most people. I would think, I'm assuming in this situation, the employee is also good, someone you actually want to hire that would be good in the jobs they're applying for. I would think, well, damn, this employee is a great employee, but I don't want to piss off my friend. You know, I'll just talk to my friend. I'll just, you know, I'll explain to her, you know, like, I didn't know about this. I just found out about it. But they're going to leave your company anyways. Why don't, you know, it's better with me than someone you hate. And most likely, your friend's going to understand. So yeah, you know, it's a one-time thing. I get it. He came to you. You didn't search him out. Okay, I understand. And I think that's where my thinking on it would end. But that's where things get interesting. This is where Horowitz really surprises me with his experience. This is what actually happens. Everything I said happens. She understands. Fine. Cool. That person leaves the company, comes to work for you. Well, that person has friends at your friend's company. They have friends at the former company. And those friends at the former company are going to be like, now, where'd Tim go? He left. Where'd he go? I'm going to call him. I'm going to call him on the phone and say, dude, what happened? And he's going to say, you know, I left. I'm working for Chad's company. Blah, blah, blah. Whatever you want to call it. Blah, blah, blah. I'm working for semi-literate. And the friend is going to say, why did you leave? Like, what were your reasons? And your new employee, my new employee in this situation, is going to explain all of the logical reasons that they left. You know, whatever they are, like I was underpaid or there was no room for me to move up or the projects were no longer interesting or whatever the reasons are. Logical reasons. Well, because they're logical reasons, they're going to make sense to this other person. This other employee that still works for your friend. This person's going to start looking at the company and going, another damn good point. Maybe I should get out of here too. And now all of a sudden, they're going to want to leave the company. And where do you think they're going to go first? They're going to go over here where your friend, you know, their friend just said, hey, I went over here. It's great over here. It's semi-literate. It's fantastic. Well, they're going to interview there. And they're going to tell their friends that they're doing that. And the next thing you know, you're going to have a bunch of your friends' employees applying at your company. Before you know it, because once again, you're up high. So you don't know that these people are moving up through the interview process. And by the time you find out, some of these people have made it pretty far through the process and there's a bunch of them. And your friend's sitting over at the company going, what the hell is going on here? And the other people are, you know, squawking in her ear. Her executives are going, your friend is raiding our company. You haven't done anything. But to everybody else, it looks like you're stealing all of her employees. So now she, even if she doesn't believe that, she looks weak. She looks like a bad CEO because all these other employees and executives are going, she can't even stop these people, her friend, from stealing her employees. And somewhere in there, whether it is that she chooses to believe you're raiding her company or that the repercussions of people seeing her as weak and her company starts to falter because of that, she's going to blame you and you will no longer have a friend. Those are unseen repercussions. That's the part about this book that I really dug. Like, whoa, wouldn't have gone there. Here's another one. So you have an engineer. And an engineer, if you hear, by the way, if you hear a weird sound in the background, apparently the sprinklers came on in the middle of this recording. And the pipes are on the wall about 5 feet away from me. So you might hear the water. Sorry about that. Okay, so other situation. Engineer has an offer at another company. Your engineer has an offer at another company. She's not your top engineer, but she's part of a project that's really important. And that project is probably going to go to shit if you lose this person who knows all about it. So you want to keep her. So what do you do? Well, it seems logical, right? You want to keep her? Top the offer. She's got an offer for, you know, 100K. Give her 110K. Whatever. I don't even know if that's a good topping. Well, let's make it extreme. Give her 150K, okay? So that seems all well and good. You kept the employee. The project is going to go through. Yeah, you might be overpaying for her, but you know, what you're really paying for is the project, right? And a decent engineer. Not your best, but a good engineer. Well, she has friends, as we all do at work, and I'm sure that she told her friends about the offer, right? Like, I've got this offer at this other company. I'm thinking about maybe taking it. And at least one of those friends probably told her, you should take it. That's a good offer. You should take that. They give this advice, right? And then they see her sitting at her desk. What are you still doing here? Well, you're this engineer, she has to save face, you know, because you have to save public face and somehow you got to maintain your relationships. So she tells this friend, what happened? You know, I didn't take your advice because this company where we are just topped the offer of the other company. So why not stay where I'm already here? You know, I'm already here, but I got 150. The other offer was only 100. Well, that friend of hers is going to, number one, he's going to be pissed off at the idea that she had to threaten to leave in order to get a deserved raise. But he's also probably going to be pissed because she's making a shitload more money than he is. So he's going to be passive aggressive about that. He's not going to sabotage her, but he is going to tell other people. And he may be nice, you know, Horowitz says, and here he says, he may be nice and leave her name out of it and just say, someone in this department is making $50,000 to $60,000 more than the rest of us. And that's going to spread through the department. So you're going to have some pissed off employees, but what you're also going to have is a perpetuation through a department and maybe through the company that the best way to get a raise is to go get another offer somewhere else and threaten to leave. Unforeseen repercussions. Some of the other parts of this isn't really a repercussions thing, but this is about thinking. I guess, actually, you know what? This is an unseen repercussion situation. So at a point in the book, the point in his story, Horowitz decides to sell Loud Cloud. And he's going to sell Loud Cloud to EDS. I know that you don't know anything about these companies. It doesn't matter. I just can't say one company to the other company. Otherwise, we'll get completely confused here. Just don't worry about what the companies do or any of that. It's not important to this retelling. Read the book to find out. How's that? I'm sure Horowitz appreciate me saying that at least once in here. Read his book. So part of the deal, this is the way it's going to go, is I think they had like 450 employees. About a third of them are going to stay with him. So there's a software that they used at LoudCloud, and he's going to take that software, it's called Opsware, and make a separate company out of just the software. So he's actually changing industries. So he's selling off that. And so a third of those companies from LoudCloud, about 150, 140, 50 people, are going to stay with him at Opsware. A third of them are part of the deal. So they're effectively being sold as employees to EDS. And about a third of them are going to get laid off. And I guess the deal, I don't remember why, but they need to go to New York to announce this deal. I don't know if that's where investors are or something like that, but they need to go to New York and tell people that, you know, we're selling LoudCloud. Here's the deal. EDS is buying LoudCloud for blah, blah, blah. So Horowitz kind of starts getting ready to go to New York. And this guy, Bill Campbell, who works for him and is a former CEO of a couple companies, I think, he tells him, no. You're the CEO. You can't go to war into New York. Send Mark Andreessen to New York. But you're the CEO. You have to stay here. Because when people find out about this sale and they know that a third of them are staying, a third of them are going to EDS, and a third of them are getting laid off, they need to know where they stand. And you're the one who needs to tell them where they stand. Which, when I hear that, what I think of is, you know, like the duty of the captain, you know, like that is the responsibility. Like, is it kind of in a way? It's like the captain goes down with the ship, except this isn't a sinking ship situation. But it's just like this responsibility that comes with your position. I don't do a lot of quotes. I try not to do a lot of quotes in these episodes. I'll probably do at least one more after this, but. One quote that I think I actually had to go back to the book, because at the time I read the book, I didn't think it was that big of a deal, the quote. It didn't seem like a key point to me. But then in the days since I finished reading it, I kept trying to remember this quote. And I think it encapsulates this idea of unseen repercussions. And that he says, tip to aspiring entrepreneurs. If you don't like choosing between horrible and cataclysmic, don't become CEO. Another part of this book that, you know, it's not just the stuff that I've been talking about here. He also, he's giving out a lot of advice, like a lot of advice throughout this book. And I'm not going to, obviously, like I said, this isn't a review of the book. You're like, let's tour the whole book. I'll tell you some of the ones that I found were interesting. But before I do that, there is something that I should mention here, because I do think I wouldn't say it's a key part of the book, but it is a part of the book that stands out, that makes it stand out among other business books. And that's the sections. He begins the sections of the book by quoting from hip-hop lyrics. And the pertinence of the hip-hop lyrics are usually dead on. So, just felt like there was at least one place where I had to mention that. So, we'll do a quick survey here of some of the other advice that he gives here that I liked. And then we'll cut this episode. Cut it and print it, if anybody knows what the hell that means anymore. So, one of the things he talks about is that we often waste resources looking for problems when there aren't actually problems. What you actually need in the situation is clarity. So I guess the best way to explain that a little bit better is something doesn't feel right. Something's not working. So you start looking for a problem. Okay, what's the problem? okay, what are our solutions? Well, you start going through that thought process when sometimes all you really need to do is clarify things. The reason things are not going well is because things aren't clear. Like an example of like, if you have a company with two CEOs, dual CEOs, there's a lack of clarity there because people don't know which to report to. I mean, is it really just either of you, or like, do I have to tell you both? So it seems like there's a problem, but it's not a problem. You just need to clarify. Actually, in that situation, what he would say is you need to get rid of one of them. You only need one CEO. But you get my point, hopefully. Another one, my favorite, one of my favorites, skip the shit sandwich. Not a direct quote, but the shit sandwich part is a direct quote. If you're not familiar with this term, the shit sandwich is is what employees like to call the method of criticism that is taught to management by mediocre business coaches. And the shit sandwich is this. Your first slice, your slice of bread is a compliment. Then there's the shit, which is the criticism. And then there's the other slice of bread, which is another compliment. So as you know that I really value you as an employee, but this coming in late every day is not working for me. But I just want you to know that we want to work with you because you're a valued member of the team. That's the shit sandwich. What he says to do instead is just be direct. Just tell people, like, here's the problem. And what's important when you do that is you have to ask yourself a question as a manager. Do I want this person to succeed? Or do I want them to fail? Because whether you mean to or not, the way that you communicate to that employee will come from that position. If you want them to fail, they will know. So the compliments of the shit sandwich aren't going to do any good. And if you want them to succeed, you can just come from that place of wanting them to succeed and have a genuine conversation about them succeeding. When you have to fire an executive, this is a line of thought that I loved. Sometimes I love things and I'm not sure why I love them. And sometimes it's just the cleverness of the idea. It's that somebody sees something and they've reframed it in a way that makes it fresh and interesting. When you have to fire an executive, it's because of problems in your hiring process. It's not actually the executive that's the problem. It's that you did a shitty job of finding a good person to fit into that job. And you have to ask yourself, whenever you have to have let an executive go, why did we hire the wrong person? What is wrong with our hiring process and how can we improve it? You can, to some degree, you can use the exit interview to determine that. But you really have to do some internal logic examination. What are we putting out? What are we looking for that's what we're not actually looking for? I love that reframing. Now, this is, I said I was going to quote him one more time. I would say that this is probably a quote that a lot of people pull from this book. And that's feedback is a dialogue, not a monologue. And what he means by that is when you give feedback, it's not like this hammer coming down. Like, I've said my piece, the end. When you give feedback, it's opening a door. You should be saying, here's what I think. One of the example that he gives is if someone is presenting a project, putting forth a project, this person's been in charge or one of the people in charge of this project, so they're presenting it and the presentation is lacking. So you give feedback. what you should be doing is opening the door to that conversation, because while that is the way that you see things, it doesn't mean you're right. Because that project, that person knows that project or should know that project better than you do. So you should be opening that door and giving them the opportunity to prove you wrong. Now, I understand what you're saying with your feedback, but you're not taking into account this, this, and this. Oh, you're right. You're right. I wasn't even aware that those were involved, that those were issues here. When you do things like that, you're encouraging high-level thinking. And yeah, obviously, as a CEO, that would be important, but I can't think of a situation where you wouldn't want to encourage high-level thinking. This is where you can understand to some degree, I hope, how these things are applicable. Applicable? Applicable? Which enunciation do you prefer? You could understand how you could use these in situations that don't relate to being a CEO. I can, and I'm just a podcaster. And going along with that, I think to some degree that the idea of feedback and dialogue, he says that CEOs should have opinions on everything and they should be sharing them all the time. In a way, this is almost like fits in that reframing things, like, and it gives me that same feeling of surprise that those unforeseen repercussions gave me. Like, really? Like, I would think that a CEO would want to be pretty tight-lipped. But he says that if you're constantly sharing your opinions, then people won't take them personally. When you are tight-lipped and you save your opinions and you only give them here or there, people take them personally. If it's a good opinion, they take it personally, like with pride. But if it's a bad one, it's targeted and they know that and they think it's about them instead of about your opinion. And that's dangerous. So give them freely. Give opinions freely so that they become just something people are used to hearing. And what will happen is that the employees will also become comfortable discussing problems because you discuss problems all the time. So they will be able to discuss problems, not only each other's problems, but problems within the company, which you may not be aware of. Most CEOs don't know there are problems until way after all the employees know their problems. But healthy company cultures encourage that sharing of bad news. Most of the employees, like I said, they know that there's a problem way before anybody else. But of course, they keep it quiet because that's what they think they're supposed to do. But if you encourage that, then you can see the problems really early and you can deal with them before they become disastrous. And lastly, this is where I'm going to end because I think it encapsulates kind of something about the whole book, but I think that this is one that I took the most meaning from myself. And actually, I think to some degree, this came up in an episode of my other podcast, Brainstorms, with my friend Lam, when we were talking about, I think it's episode 6, we're talking about the Instagram enigma, how to use Instagram. And I'm pretty sure that I wish that I had this quote at that moment because it fits so well into that episode. But he says that if you talk to CEOs of all kinds, what you'll find out is that the good ones and the mediocre ones, when they look back, they talk a lot about the choices they had to make and the reasons for their success and survival, how they had to do with the choices and the situations and the personnel. But when you talk to the great CEOs, you know, the Steve Jobs, the Bill Gates, like that level of people, they all say the same thing on why things went well. They went well because they didn't quit. They faced the pain. So for me, that's like a little mantra I'm taking from this book. Face the pain. Don't quit. Face the pain. Starting a podcast with very little listeners every week, looking at the numbers, wondering if it's going to grow. It's really easy to want to quit. But face the pain. Don't quit. Trying to build an Instagram or a Twitter. Really difficult to break through the noise. But face the pain. Stick with it. Don't quit. Trying to write a novel. It's hard. Like what he says here in here about the only way to learn how to be a CEO is to be a CEO. There is no prep for it. The only way to write a novel is to write a novel. There is no prep for it. No matter how many people write books about both things, the only way to learn it is to do it. And the only way to do it is to keep doing it. To not